got a problem here. There's lots and lots of diagrams and lots of books, including the ARRL antenna book, where they will show you a diagram of a planar electromagnetic wave propagating toward the observer. You have a whole bunch of vertical arrows, and the whole diagram looks like a piece of window screening that's been blown up in magnification. You got a bunch of vertical arrows, which sometimes are shown red, and they're called E-field lines. You got a whole bunch of blue arrows that are horizontal, and they're called the H-field lines. The wave itself in free space has blue horizontal arrows representing H-field vectors in units of amps per meter. The vertical red lines in my diagram have a E-field magnitude in volts per meter. The wave itself requires two components, horizontal H, vertical E, and that planar wave propagates at right angles to the two of those, transverse electromagnetic. There's an electro and a magnetic to it. There's a real E field in space. Not that you just sense it because there's a magnetic field creating the sense of the E field in your detector. You can build a pure E field detector that has no response to magnetic field in theory, and you will sense that E field. You can build a pure magnetic detector, and you will sense that H field without sensing the E field. They are both independently there, really in space, I believe, Glenn. You and I might differ on this one. Over to you, Glenn, KQLAW.
If I were to look at units for Gauss or Tesla, you know, basically just moving a decimal point back and forth on that, whether you're going to use CGS or MKS, and how do you calculate Gauss? It's volts time over area. Okay? But that's still a magnetic unit for Gauss. It's flux density. You know, so is there a voltage relationship to flux density? Absolutely there is. But in order to get that voltage relationship back, you have to intersect it with the right-hand rule and introduce a voltage and a current again back into a copper wire. But in free space, that unit of flux density is a dimension with respect to H, which is the magnetic field itself. I mean, Oersted. Yeah, H or Oersted versus Gauss. But here again, Dick, I don't see the, you know, the issue or the problem with that, with the, you know, measuring the E field or B field, and, you know, the unit is still Gauss or Tesla, and the other field is H and Oersted's. Unless you think it's a, is it a different unit that you're talking about? KC2, QIQ.
I say yes, Glenn. We're definitely talking about a different unit. When you look at all of those words in your Webster or whatever dictionary, even a technical dictionary, you look up Oersted, Weber, Tesla, Gauss, you look up all of those words, they will only be discussing magnetism. Let me give you another example, off to one side. I'm pouring some power into a 50-ohm resistor. By some magic, I know that the resistor is exactly 50 ohms. And now I get four different ways that I can find out how much power is going in that resistor. I can do some calorimetry and measure the temperature and the rate of temperature rise of the resistor. That tells you how much power the resistor is really absorbing. I can measure the current that's flowing through the resistor in amperes. And knowing that it's a 50 ohm resistor, I squared R, I can calculate the power. I can measure the voltage drop across the resistor. And by the calculation E squared over R, I can calculate the power. And it's probably a third way. I can use a watt-hour meter. So I can measure how much energy per unit of time is going into that resistor, and I got at least three or four different kinds of instrumentation that, if done carefully, can give me the right answer. But when I'm measuring volts across that resistor, I'm not measuring amps. I'm measuring something I can calculate into amps, but I'm not measuring amps. Or correspondingly, when I'm measuring current flowing through resistor, I'm measuring amps. I'm not measuring voltage. I could calculate the voltage, but I'm measuring amperes. When I'm measuring the temperature of that resistor, and temperature versus time, I'm measuring the total energy getting to the resistor. And knowing it's a 50-ohm resistor, I can work the mathematics backwards and predict what the voltage was and predict what the current is, but I'm measuring temperature. I'm measuring energy dissipated by the resistor. Now I go back to my similar diagram. Let me drop. Similar diagram of an electromagnetic field. All of those words that you used, Oersted, Weber, Tesla, Gauss, lines of flux, every one of those words is a pure magnetic word in the steady state world. If I'm in the dynamic world and there's a rate of change of one of those magnetic effects, yes, in free space where I know there's 377 ohms, very similar to that resistor. I knew it was a 50 ohm resistor. In free space, I know it's a 377 ohm apparent impedance. I can measure the rate of change of one of any one of those magnetic effects, and I can predict what the E field would be had I measured the E field. But those are not units of E field. E field, to my knowledge, is only measured in volts per meter, real volts apparently existing in free space. They happen to be caused by the rate of change of the local magnetic field, but there really is an E field there. I can build a kind of a instrumentation probe that is only sensitive to volts and volts per meter and has no sensitivity to any kind of steady state magnetic field. I can build that kind of a probe with a field effect transistor. You and I could easily do that. I could use a field effect transistor as a 50 megohm probe in space. That's how an E field voltage probe antenna works. A voltage probe antenna is only sensitive to E field as it passes by. It sucks no energy out of that field. It tells you the voltage that is there, very similar to your digital voltmeter. It's got a 10 megohm input impedance, not like your old VOM meter where the current flowing through the damn thing really moved the meter. A modern-day digital voltmeter senses the presence of the voltage. It doesn't suck any power out of the circuit per se. So let me drop one more time. I'm reasonably sure that there's some pretty darn good instrument, pretty darn good documentation. The ANSI report, the ICNIRP report, the FCC requirements, the IEEE requirements for electromagnetic compatibility. All of these have real units of radiated signal in space represented in volts per meter, and they're really talking about volts. They're not I'll admit that those volts were created by the rate of change of a magnetic field, but there still is a real voltage in space present in that wave, I believe. And you and I might have a slight difference in religion on this one, so to speak, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, I didn't think that we were so far apart on this one. I thought I explained this one a few times, but, I mean, realistically, if you look at charge and Q, and it's all based on electrons and Coulomb counts, and you're basically talking about material. You're talking about matter. So when you have voltage charge in a capacitor, there's actually electron count, and you can quantize that because there's matter involved in that, in every electron count and matter. You can't have electricity or voltage and current without matter. It's absolutely, you know, must be. It's like Ohm's law, volts, amps, and resistance. That matter must be present. Electrons must be present to have current flow and an electrostatic voltage in Q. Electromagnetics? No electrons necessary, Dick. Absolutely none whatsoever. Pure vacuum, baby. 100% all the way. You can generate an electromagnetic field that has a flux density and a flux field itself, H, Oersted's versus Gauss or Tesla, whichever one you want to use. Now you can alternate it in free space, in a dimension of the resistance of free space calculated. That can run right through a vacuum, can go anywhere else, and displace at an impedance of approximately 377 ohms. And it will displace like that, right through free space, without even coming in contact with one electron in between. Until, of course, you put something in between, some kind of a copper or something that will interfere with that field, and all of a sudden, boom, now you get the other units back. You get now, because you've introduced another material in its way, a piece of matter, copper, that will intersect, and you can create a current flow and a voltage, and you can read those amplitudes again. So for measurement capabilities, you must have a piece of matter in between in order to make the measurement. KC2, QIQ.
Okay, I think you're saying, and I'm going to agree with you on this one, every one of our electromagnetic transducers, whether it be a transmitting antenna, a receiving antenna, an E-field probe, an H-field probe, part of a Satomo machine, those individual 64 probes that are in that three-dimensional antenna plotting machine made in France. Every one of these is within itself getting some electrons flow. By the way, you said that matter must flow in order for there to be a wave. You didn't use quite those words, but in my opinion, that electromagnetic wave, once it is launched in free space, does not have mass, per se. Now, we can talk about the mass of a neutrino, something so darn close to zero that for all practical purposes it's zero. And the photons that are in an electromagnetic wave, the amount of mass there is so small, so close to zero that I think it's zero, and yet a tremendous amount of energy can be flowing. 1,000 watts per square meter is coming out of that sun. And the radiation pressure that people thought they were measuring with a radiometer, that's the thing with four blades inside of a glass bulb, and the thing spins. And you figure out which direction it spins, and all of a sudden you're in trouble. Because when it comes to the momentum of that wave hitting the shiny side of those four blades, that should have twice as much momentum as the wave hitting the black sides. And therefore, the shiny sides should move away from the sun. It does exactly the opposite. The black side always moves away from the sun. That's a pretty strong piece of evidence that there is no significant radiation pressure from the electromagnetic wave, which is a very strong wave. 1,000 watts per square meter is coming to you every day at high...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Every day at high noon from that sun, you're getting 1,000 watts per square meter. Lots and lots of energy. Huge amount of energy. And the amount that hits your radiometer is a good fraction of a watt, if you know what I mean. And the radiometer spins in the wrong direction. Strong piece of evidence that it is not radiation pressure. That wave in space has essentially no mass. But I say it has essentially an equal amount of energy in its H field and an equal amount of energy in its E field. I can take the E field in volts per meter. I can square it, E squared over R, and calculate the energy. Or I can use the instrumentation where I measure the H field in amps per meter. Square it and multiply it by 377, come up with the amount of energy of that wave, the power flux density. A voltage probe antenna is the one that's got a 10 to the 12 ohm field effect transistor as the front end. A tiny little probe that in most cases is a thousandth of a wavelength long, sticking above a ground plane. And it goes into the gate of the field effect transistor, which has got 10 to the 12 or 10 to the 14 ohms of impedance. You can't talk about the power that's going into that thing. That is a pure E-field sensing device, a voltage probe antenna. Works like a charm. It doesn't see one iota of magnetic field. It only sees E field of the wave as it passes by and sucks no energy out of that wave. Very similar to your digital voltmeter. Because its impedance is so high, it sucks no power, no energy out of the circuit that you're measuring per se. It senses the fact that voltage is there. Lights up that light emitting diode screen and tells you how many volts are there. That's what your digital voltmeter does. But it's only measuring E field. A voltage probe antenna looking at a 1 megacycle wave using a probe that's a 16th of an inch long. You can calculate what fraction of a millionth of a wavelength that is. It measures...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It measures that local E field, does it beautifully. I say that that wave definitely has part of its energy as pure volts per meter. I'll admit that the H wave has got to be present, but I can build instrumentation, a voltage probe antenna does it, it only sees E field. Does that sound wrong to you, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
Okay, I agree with the part as far as the voltmeter will measure voltage. I mean, you put a probe out there and it will sense that voltage. High impedance device, etc., whatever. But there's still a right-hand rule effect going on here, Dick, because keep in mind one thing about the units that are involved here. Whenever we're talking about voltage or current, okay, we're talking about basically coulombs, and the the amount of voltage that's built up that's present at that point. Electrons are required for, and mass are required to measure volts or have current. Because if there's no electron count and no proton count, you can't have current flow in coulombs and express the charge in Q. Matter is a requirement for voltage and current measurements. So to have a true E field in terms of charge to measure a voltage or a current, electrons are definitely required. Let me let it drop for 1 second.
Does an electroscope require current to flow? That's the thing with those two gold leaves that separate when the thing is put near an E field. No current must flow into that instrument, but it tells you what the local charge is. Over to you, Glenn.
As insignificant as it is, yes, that's true. But the reality is that you're sensing an electron in that field. That mass is required. Do you agree with me that in order to have charge, voltage, and current, that electrons and mass are requirements?
When I charge up the two spheres of my Van de Graaff generator, without a doubt, there's a whole lot of electrons on one sphere, and there's a dearth of electrons on the other sphere. I can bring my electroscope near either of those spheres, and just by the close proximity of the local static, electrostatic field around those two charged spheres, those two gold leaves inside of the electroscope will separate, telling me that there is charge present in that vicinity. Not a single electron flowed from that either of those spheres into that electroscope, and there were no electrons in space per se, just that there was a local E field. The electroscope sensed it. I'll admit that within the electroscope some current moved. Some electrons moved down to those two gold leaves and they got repelled against each other. Within the electroscope, I'll admit that current flowed. But no current flowed from the outside universe into that electroscope when it gave that instrumentation reading. Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, here again I agree with you. In other words, but electrons are present. You agree with that. In order for there to be a unit of voltage or current in coulombs at a rate, electrons have to be present, otherwise those units don't work. Do you understand what I'm saying there?
Are there electrons present in an electromagnetic field wave, electromagnetic wave? The astronaut turned on his transmitter, he's standing on the moon, and the signal's coming down to the Goldstone dish in California. In free space, I could put a satellite there and intercept that signal if I wanted to, or not if I don't want to. Are there any electrons in that electromagnetic wave that is flowing from the moon toward the Earth in the vacuum of space? Are there any electrons present there that are part of that wave, Glenn? Go ahead.
I think you're jumping ahead on me here because I'm trying to make a point and you're not letting me do it. But did you understand what I first said about the electrons and voltage and current, that mass and electrons are a requirement? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think I'm going to agree. Within our instrumentation, electrons have to flow somewhere. Current has to flow somewhere within the instrumentation in order for the instrumentation to tell me something. And by various means, the outside universe creates that movement of electrons and current and charge within my instrumentation. And an electromagnetic wave being received by some kind of a sensing device can do that. But I say the wave itself has a real E field without electrons, as long as it's changing at the right rate, if you know what I mean. Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, so we agree that in order to make those units work, voltage, current, electrons, and electron counts are a requirement. It's just part of the basic science units of volts, amps. That's part of the makeup. When you break down the scientific units, the electrons are a requirement. That's what voltage and current are. Now let's look at magnetic components for a minute. Gauss. Let's look at the H and Oersted's. And what is it? Now, is there any electron count in there? Is there any mass requirement in any of those units, in Weber's, permeability, mu, any of those? There's nothing in any of those scientific units that is represented or tied to any mass. Do you agree with me on that one?
Since all the good books say that you create a magnetic field, by having charged particles that are in motion. From that point of view, I'm going to agree with you. So the movement of charged particles creates a magnetic field. And in the case of a steady-state magnetic device, like a neodymium iron cobalt magnet, neodymium iron boron, in the case of a magnet, it's a little bit more difficult to figure out where is the current flow. I think it's now it's occurring at the atomic level, or molecular level. Either at the molecular level or at the atomic level, current is flowing, and whether that current is the electrons going around the nucleus, or the electrons rotating around themselves, or the protons themselves rotating, or the nucleus rotating, I'm not quite sure. There is charged things doing the rotation at the atomic level or molecular level, creating that magnetic field in a steady-state magnet. So at the microscopic level, there appears to be current. But before we started having a theory of microscopicness, the current flow on a steady-state magnet, not an electromagnet, the current flow that's making the magnetic field in a steady-state magnet used to be a bit more mysterious, I'll bet. Over to you, Glenn.
Around around a fixed magnet or an electromagnet, whichever one you want to use, it really doesn't matter much, there's going to be a field. There'll be an H field, and it'll have a density in either Gauss or Tesla, depending on which unit you want to use. But that's the density of the field, and the H is the dimension of the size of it. Now, you can measure that in free space around the magnet. That has nothing to do with the magnet whatsoever. In other words, it's being generated by the magnet, but it's that field is around the magnet, and there is absolutely no mass in any of those units whatsoever that represents that field. Do you follow me on that?
I think I do. And all those lines of flux, in theory, coming out of the north end of that fixed magnet and going back into the south end, all of those lines of flux, the number of lines per square centimeter is defined once I make a measurement, and every one of them must close back on themselves. They're all clotheslines. Some of them go out very long distances before they close, but they all close. And yes, those lines themselves are this thing that you and I call magnetism. We call it H field. Call them H lines. They themselves have no measurable mass. And yet, they're capable of, when properly used, being part of the components that create energy. You've got to be careful on that one. Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, now let's say we know that there's a field out there. It's got an H field, and it has an intensity of B in Gauss or Tesla, and that's that field around the outside. Now we're not going to use a fixed magnet anymore. Now we're going to use an electromagnetic coil. We're going to pump a current into it. As I increase the current in that coil, I can increase the magnitude of B, of the B magnitude of that field, and it will get larger. If I reduce the current in that winding to approach zero, the B field will shrink, and of course the H field will reduce along with it. Do you follow me so far?
No problem right now. Go ahead.
Now I've got a really trick power supply that allows me to go from zero to minus voltages. And as I go to minus voltages and start increasing the current again, I will have a reverse field. The north and south now are in the opposite direction, and I will generate a field amplitude of Gauss represented to the current that's flowing in that coil and that field around the outside. Do you follow me there? It works exactly the same way as it did in the positive direction.
Now, I think I see where you're going. Now, I'm going to give you a sinusoidal current flowing through that electromagnetic solenoid coil, and you're going to make a cyclic magnetic field that goes plus and minus, up and down, in a sinusoidal manner. When we plot B versus time, or H versus time, we can see a sine wave where it goes through zero and goes to a peak in a valley, and it does it exactly at the cyclic rate of the current that you've got flowing through that winding. So you're now making a cyclic magnetic field, and I'm with you up to this point. Go ahead.
So we're agreeing with the units now that the magnetic field intensity is B, right, and the H field is the basic dimension around the source. In this particular case, the source is an electromagnetic coil, and the area around that has got a closed loop, right? In other words, so in other words, that magnetic field is closed around that magnetic coil, so, and that has that's called a path length. So it's got a path length, and the amount of area or the thickness that the flux density is around is the cross-sectional area of that field. Do you follow me so far?
I think I do. And depending on what materials you're using, ferromagnetic materials, you and I could generate a DH curve, where one is the motive force in ampere turns into the coil, and the other is the resultant magnetic field that it created. And at least near zero, near the unity of our XY axis, it's going to be a straight line. If I use the right units, I'll get a beautiful straight 45-degree line up to the point where I start saturating the magnetic materials. And in other words, there's no more domains left to be aligned, so to speak, and I can't make a stronger magnetic field in the material, even though I'm increasing the ampere turns. That's the typical DH curve and this hysteresis loop that we plot for a particular kind of ferromagnetic material. And that I could be using as the loop stick that is an antenna, and I can transmit a radio wave with that antenna. Over to you, Glenn.
Okay, but we're not going to use any ferrite material right now. We just have a coil. We know that there's, we have a coil that we're inducing current in. We know when we put plus voltages on it, we get a Gauss, a flux intensity, and a dimension to a field. We know its path length around the coil, and it has a dimension. And if we hold that coil where we initially start the positive in one direction, and the top of it becomes north, and the bottom of it becomes south, and we look at that field that's building around the outside, it's got the path length, and it's got a flux density around it. And we know that now as we move it up and down in current in that coil from plus to zero to minus, the unit of that field, of that electromagnetic field around the outside, is Gauss in terms of its flux density, and it's, and we know what its initial dimension is. Now we're going to start exercising it with AC. Are you following me so far in my model?
Yes, I am. Go right ahead. And by the way, the nice thing about air is that it's got a beautiful BH curve that has no hysteresis of the air, and maybe some of the materials you've used. So I'm going to get a beautiful 45-degree line in my BH curve. But go ahead.
Okay, and this is where it gets a little tricky for most. What will happen is if you start to plot, okay, from the first initial field, the field length that goes around the geometry of that coil to the air around the outside, that's the original path length field, and you start to go positive to zero, minus, and then back again, and plot B versus H as it's moving along, you'll wind up with a vector of flux intensity in a field that's moving around the outside that will move up and down. And if you do it a second time, what will happen is the first field will displace one wavelength ahead of the next field that's starting to build up right behind it. And you build a third one, and the third one will wind up in a dimension. But it's three-dimensional. So when you're viewing this, as this field is radiating away in dimension, because what it's basically doing is it's time that's expanding the distance from the initial path length. Do you follow me so far?
When I made the nearly steady state current flow through the coil, and I looked at those lines of flux, the majority of the lines were very close, coming out of the north end of the solenoid, going back into the south end. But a couple of those lines went off to a very long distance before they closed. As I start raising the frequency of the excitation to the solenoid coil, I eventually get to the point where some of those very far magnetic lines did not get a chance to collapse. They didn't have enough time to come back home. And the next cycle is coming along of the opposite polarity. And the net result is that line that was way out there at a long distance must close upon itself locally. It doesn't have the time to come back to the original exciting device, the solenoid coil. So as I raise the frequency high enough, I'm making individual loops of magnetic field in space, and that's what the Voyager is now seeing coming from the sun. Although the frequency of the sun's rate of change of magnetic field is very slow, you go twice the distance of Pluto, you will see these individual so-called bubbles of magnetic field. I think you're beginning to describe the very far magnetic fields that didn't get a chance to collapse, they form local bubbles of closed circle magnetic field. Is that approximately what you're saying, Glenn? Go ahead.
Oh, that's part of it. But that's not the whole story. Now, let's take another phenomenon. In other words, because that's the first basic part of radiation. There's the second part of electromagnetic radiation that, unfortunately, I'm going to have to probably pick up with you at a different time. I didn't realize how late it is. But I'd like to pick up this discussion maybe sometime during the week if you're around, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I can tell we're going to go a while before we come to complete agreement. But I did hear you earlier talk about Oersted, Webers, and whatever as voltage terms. And my dictionary calls every one of those magnetic terms. So when it comes to dictionary definition and the way we use them, we maybe have a little bit of a difference there. We'll meet during the week, Glenn. Yes, it's getting late for all of us. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Good while.
Go ahead, Bernie.
Quick question that came up as part of your discussion. If I have a radio wave that impacts an antenna and then continues going past that antenna, does that antenna take anything out of that radio wave? For example, if I start at the Empire State Building and send a radio signal over my house, my antenna picks it up and it continues to your house further out on the island. Did my receiving of that radio wave take anything out of it?
You've asked a beauty, Bernie. The answer is yes and no. 99% of the time, the majority of antennas we use are energy intercepting devices, electromagnetic transducers. An ordinary dipole that's at your house, and your house is upstream from me. In other words, here's my antenna on my house. I have to look through your antenna to see the Empire State Building. That's what's transmitting the signal. And I'm measuring the signal strength I get from the Empire State Building. And tomorrow morning you erect your yucky antenna. And now the signal strength I get from the Empire State Building definitely decreases. You've sucked energy out of that wave. Real energy. I mean, you've got a 50-ohm antenna and some number of microvolts have been expressed across it. You have sucked energy out of that wave. That's conservation of energy. But there's a catch. If I can convince you to build an E-field probe antenna, the kind that senses the presence of the voltage without sucking energy out of the wave, if I can convince you to do that, there can be 1,000 houses between me and the Empire State Building, and none of them are sucking up any of that energy per se. Now the signal I get does not become weaker. I'll admit that these E-field probe antennas, except for some fancy military programs, are very rarely used. They should be used more. Because that antenna is so rare, what you're saying, sucking up energy, is true 99.99% of the time. But it doesn't have to be. Over to you, Bernie.
Now, is the amount of the energy of that signal that I take significant enough that if I get enough of my neighbors to put up antennas that you would never receive the signal?
The answer is absolutely no for two or three crazy reasons. Whenever somebody transmits a radio wave, the hard thing to believe is that that wave goes out, obeys the inverse square law, in theory it goes out in all directions in space. It never stops. You transmit a radio wave, it goes to every single cubic centimeter of this universe, and I'm not kidding. It even gets inside of that perfectly made screen room in Edwards Air Force Base, the Benfield Anechoic Facility at Edwards Air Force Base, inside of his room, which is 100 dB tempest proof. That signal that you generate, some of it gets inside of that room. It goes to every cubic centimeter of the universe. The only thing left to discuss is the signal when it gets there. Is it above threshold of the instrumentation that I'm using at that location? In theory, if you transmit a slow enough wave for a long enough period of time, and if I integrate for a long enough period of time, I can measure the magnitude of that signal that's inside of that anechoic chamber. It's damn difficult. It never goes to zero. That's one side of it. But the more people that are between me and the Empire State Building, the more people you talk into putting up antennas, I get a weaker and weaker signal. It never goes to zero, but it gets weaker and weaker. Over to you, Bernie.
Okay, I think I'm going to have to bow out because I think I understand that. I think I've got my arms wrapped around it. But that's going to give me some food for thought for a little while now. Thank you, Dick. Have a great evening, K2YO.
Yeah. How far away from the Earth do you have to get because the gravity you sense from the Earth goes to zero? What would your answer to that one be, Bernie?
Well, the theoretical answer is you never can. It's that old adage, if I put you 10 feet away from a wall and ask you to close to the wall by half the distance, you'll never reach the wall. So it's by that same principle, the gravity never goes away.
That's slightly different principles, but I agree. Yeah. The gravity from this planet, no matter how far away you are, it becomes more and more difficult to measure, but it never goes to zero. The radio wave you transmit from this planet, no matter how far away you are, it gets weaker and weaker, but never goes to zero. Nothing goes to zero if you've got the right instrumentation. Crazy. Everything that works by the inverse square law, nothing goes to zero. It may become weak enough that the signal-to-noise ratio for the rate at which I want to demodulate that signal is useless. It's a pretty noisy signal. But you can always build a bigger antenna or a lower noise trigger receiver, and you can always use more and more integration. There's a way that, in theory, you and I could build a 100-watt transmitter, transmit the right kind of repetitive pulses, bounce those pulses off of the planet Venus, and listen to the echo that comes back. As crazy as that sounds, it has been done. Over to you, Bernie.
That I don't doubt. One evening, when it's earlier in the evening, I'd like to get your take on the long delay responses. I'm probably using the wrong term here, but the HF guys can make a transmission and then hear it back seconds later. I'd love to hear your theories on that, but let's save that for another night. Get too wild.
Yeah, those are called LDEs, Lima Delta Echoes, long delayed echoes, and oh boy, there's a lot of theories on that one. Okay, it's getting a little bit late for everybody. I know that poor old Wesley didn't get a chance to answer all his questions, ask his questions tonight, but though we had some interesting discussions anyhow. This was TechNet number 1353. We've got to quit. There's a lot more to go. We're all blind leading the blind on this one, as you can tell, Wesley, Bernie, Glenn, all of us. None of us are experts on any of this jazz. We're all slowly trying to find out what is Mother Nature telling us. How does this stuff work at the atomic level, at the macroscopic level, at the coax level, at the antenna level, at the interstate level? How does all this stuff work? Ain't easy. We're trying, and we'll be back next week, and we'll whittle away at this mountain a little bit more. We ain't going to get there, but we're going to get a little closer. Over to you, Wesley, N2XJN, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Comment?
Person with comment, go right ahead.
Boy, it's hard to get into you. You're quick on the draw there. This is KG6LIN. Appreciate listening to you guys. First time listener here, and wow, I need to listen more often. Someone just mentioned to me that Sunday nights you've got this thing going on 9126, I think it is, or something like that. Anyway, name here is Peter. I'm currently mobile in Southern California. But have you discussed before the possibility of, for example, time and all these other things that you think go infinitesimally small, having some quantum units, you know, like time being, if you measure it finely enough, actually has packets, so to speak, although we cannot measure them since we cannot break down time fine enough. Just a thought, just a comment. Back to you.
Now, I'm looking right now at where Thousand Oaks is, where you live. And let's see, I've been at Point Magoo Naval Base a while ago, which is not too far from where you, Camarillo, Oxnard, sure enough, I see. Fort Hamamini. I know where you are. Been there. Did some work at the. Let me think now. What is it called? Point Magoo Naval Air Warfare Station Weapons Division. That's what it's called. This TechNet, to answer your question part of the way, Pete, has existed since 1982. It doesn't get, in the beginning, it didn't get anywhere near this deep. Let me drop for a second. It started off as a one-hour get-together of guys in the New York City area. And this is the main source of this technical net that you're listening to is a repeater on Long Island, New York, in the New York City area. And it's now being carried by Echo Link and IRLP and various repeaters and whatever. So it's getting a little bit further and far and wide. And the last 6 years of this technical net are all recorded. You can go to a website and look at those recordings by going to amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor. And 6 years of recordings are there. And not all the stuff is 100% accurate. You got to be careful. But in the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, there's quite a bit of brain power. These guys get together, and they discuss their favorite subject, ham radio, wireless electronics in general. And for the last 6 months or a year, two guys have come along to get real interested in physics. And so for the second hour or so, for the last hour or so of this technical net, which now goes for 4 hours, we get into some of the nitty-gritty of what is Mother Nature really telling us. So we're seeking a truth. What's going on here, Pete, is we're fervently seeking a goal that is not clearly defined, and we're mildly crazy. KG6, Lima, India, November. K2, Romeo, India, Whiskey. My name is Dick.
Well, thanks for the brief explanation. I'll be listening here more often and get the flavor and then take a peek at your recordings and maybe listen to some of those.
K2IO for the Limark commercial.
You got it, Bernie.
And then maybe I went to the University of Illinois and studied physics and math and so on, so I just gobbled it up and totally agree that no one is an expert on this stuff. So I love reading the Scientific American, which is enough to, you know, whet your appetite on some stuff, but certainly not conclusive in anything. Anyway, it gives me a lot of ideas, and enjoy listening to you guys. So keep up the good work. And only trick is, how do I get in if I want to get in, other than fast key here? You're pretty quick on the draw, so I don't know how to get in there. But back to you, and thank you so much for the explanation. First time I've listened to you and enjoyed it. KG6LIN.
Peter, this is Bernie, K2YO. Just for a little bit of quick info about our system, I believe you came in through IRLP this evening. 9126 is our reflector. You're welcome anytime to connect up. Come on back in. We also have Echolink connections. If you go to W2VL, Whiskey 2V, whatever V is in Lima. It's getting late, I'm sorry. Dick says it's 4 hours. It's really 5 hours. And if you come in over IRLP, yes, you're just going to have to be quick on the draw and, you know, just jump in. Remember, we're a bunch of New Yorkers here, so we don't get offended. if you do come in over Echolink, there is a special feature on our Echolink that if you type the word break, B-R-E-A-K, with nothing else on the line, it will throw your call sign out on top of the conversation so that way you can always break in. So we try to give you a couple of extra features for our visiting friends from all over the country.
Thanks a lot. Like I said, let me listen in a little bit more and become familiar with the format and all the goodies there, and maybe I'll jump in at a later time. So you guys carry on, and just appreciate listening to you, and I just gobble up that sort of stuff. So. You know, you guys are good at it. I was listening here for about 5 or 6 minutes, and wow, great. So, no problem you being New Yorkers. Love the accent. Go ahead. This is KG6LIN.
I am kind of curious, Peter. This is Dick, K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. What business you're in, and what makes you be traveling around Oxnard or Thousand Oaks at this crazy hour of the night? I wonder if you work in one of the fields of technology, Peter. KG6LIN, K2RIW.
Well, thanks for asking. Like I mentioned before, I studied physics and math at the University of Illinois back in the 70s, and actually rubbed shoulders with Bardeen, great physicist and Nobel Prize winner, so I did a lot of cryogenic physics. Anyway, I have my own business now, was an engineer for many years, and currently coming back from an event up in Palo Alto. I live in Thousand Oaks. And if you go to QRZ, you'll learn a little bit more about me. This is KG6LIN.
Yeah, I'm there right now. Immigrated from Germany in 1961, University of Illinois. Okay, I've worked with some people from Alini. And guess you got to check in more often. And I guess what's going on is it's being repeated by a repeater in your neighborhood. I think you're coming through a local repeater. That's a pure guess. We have a series of tones that we're supposed to wait for so that all the machines get properly reset and so that people could jump in from out of area. But when the conversation gets hot and heavy and the people get excited, they all start jumping on top of each other, as you can tell. That's what makes it so difficult to get in. But some of the other methods by which you can join the conversation, which Bernie brought to your attention, probably will make it a little bit easier. It's almost 1 o'clock in the morning, New York time, and I've got to go to work tomorrow morning, would you believe? So back to you for a final beat, and awful nice running India. And thank you for the compliments. KG6LIN, K2 Romeo, India Whiskey.
Okay, thank you kindly here for letting me come back in. I have a micro note that I'm traveling with. My note is 8267. My Echolink note is 58267. So with this micro node, I've been able to listen to the IRLP here all the way from the Bay Area where I just came from. So it makes it really nice, as you well know. Anyway, thanks again for the time you guys gave me, and I'll be certain to listen next Sunday. I believe you start out at, 9 o'clock your time? 5 o'clock my time, I think? Or thereabouts? Or what time do you start on this net? Go ahead.
The technical net in New York City always begins 8 o'clock local time in New York City. 8 o'clock local time. And this particular technical net has existed since September of 1982. September of 1982, which is 28 and a fraction years, and this particular technical net did win a national award a few months ago for the Technical Service Award of the directors of ARRL. We gotta go, and thank you, Pete, and we'll see you down the log. KG6LIN, K2RIW, clear but listening.
Thank you very much. Really a pleasure listening to you guys, and I'll say 73 to all of you. And next time I won't be mobile and have a chance to jot some things down, and definitely we'll look it up, Google it and so on, and get more familiar. I'll be clear. KG6LIN, carry on.
Good night, Dick. Good night, Glenn. Everybody on the net. KC2WGB.
Right, guys, at 2XG, and thank you, both of you.
thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
The time is 1 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater. Net tonight at 8:30. WQVL repeater system.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.